Great. Is it the 8th today?
It's no,
the 10th.
It's the 11th.
The 11th? Time is flying by. Holy smokes.
Thank you.
All right. I'm sorry we weren't able to start on time. We're going to have to kick the good Senator Walker and her education committee out a few more minutes earlier than we tried to, because it's going to take us a few minutes to transition. So I would like first to have the committee members introduce themselves and just to say thank you for your willingness to serve on this committee. And we look forward to working with you this session and welcome. So, Senator Johnson, take it away.
Thank you very much. My name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16, Tillamook, Clatsop, Columbia, a little nibble of Washington County, and Savi Island in Multnomah County.
I'm State Senator Ted Farrioli, District 30, from nearly everywhere else. 12 counties, mostly east of the Cascades, starting almost inconceivably in Clackamas and Marion County, and going to the Idaho-Nevada border.
Good thing you have a very fast car.
That's a good.
We'll come back to you, Marjorie. Kate Brown, I represent Portland and the city of Milwaukee.
I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, and I am very honored to represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview.
And I believe we'll have Senator Nelson join us in a minute. Ms. Taylor, would you please introduce yourself and then introduce your Cracker Jack staff that we are just delighted to be working with this session?
Absolutely. I'm Marjorie Taylor, your committee administrator. I'm happy to serve. And with us, we have Krista Shuhart, and she will be the committee assistant for rules this interim. And Patricia Nelson is looking over her shoulder as we are starting our first committee meeting together.
Great. Thank you. We're going to do three things this morning, and I understand we're supposed to be on the floor at 11:30. We've asked to have all Senate Rules Committee be excused, but if you do need to go to the floor, that's totally fine. The first thing is an organizational meeting for purpose of adopting committee rules. You have them in front of you. Please take a look at them and make sure they meet with your standards and expectations. The second thing we'll be doing is opening a work session for the purposes of bill introduction, and then we will move to public hearing on Senate Bill 10, and I'll make a few remarks at that point. So let's go ahead and get started with our organizational meeting. Opening a hearing, organizational meeting for the purpose of adopting our committee rules. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I would move approval of the committee rules as distributed.
Senator Johnson
second.
Moves approvals of our committee rules. I don't believe we need a second. That's Roberts versus Masons, correct?
Correct.
Thank you. Any discussion? Any objection to the committee rules? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you all very much. I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures. We're one of the first committees to be meeting this week, so when folks approach us with bill drafts, I just gave anyone a blanket approval. We've got LC 274 to authorize payment of certain reasonable fees, expenses, and costs associated with litigation of workers' compensation claim if claimant prevails. LC 1055, which modifies circumstances requiring evaluation of injured worker for vocational assistance. We've got LC 5097, which authorizes Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to appoint and commission humane special agents. And LC 1759, to permit employees who serve food or beverages, receive tips, and report tips to employer to waive meal period. So those are the bill drafts for us. Thank you.
Madam Chair, recognizing that these are going out as committee bills, I would move LC 274, LC 1055, LC 1597, and LC 1759 be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you. Senator Johnson has moved LCs 274, 1055, 1597, and 1759 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion?
We're just moving these bills.
This does not signify your support or opposition to the measure. This is simply they're being introduced as committee bills.
Okay. I mean, I just think that what the House did with their rules doesn't make any sense, you know, limiting the $10 and...
No. We're on bill drafts here.
Okay,
sorry, okay. Senator Nelson.
I'm just reading here. Is this...
Senator Nelson.
You're ahead of us.
Okay. Madam,
I would like to just go on record as agreeing with my colleague.
Stay ahead of the record here.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, in response to Senator Nelson's question, just to clarify my motion, I move that these LCs be introduced simply to start the process with no binding commitment on anyone's part, just to get them into the process.
Including the members of the committee here. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Sarah Nelson, would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is David Nelson.
And where are you from, Sarah Nelson?
From Pendleton, Oregon, Eastern. I represent four counties in the northeast corner of the state, and Columbia River water is really my issue.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Nelson, and I think we know that, and I think everyone in this building will know that once the session is over with. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 10 and ask Ted Ruttlinger to come on forward to the dais. Colleagues, the hearing we're doing today is to provide background information on the bill before you and the Government Standards and Practices Commission. We will take public testimony if time allows today, and we're certainly committed to hearing this bill again next week. We're hoping to schedule more than one hearing over the next 2 weeks so that members of the public can participate, but we will be working with your schedules to do that because we'd like you all to be there. Also, as a clarification, and because I'm a member of the Law Commission and I know that Senator Johnson served on the work group, Senate Bill 10 is not intended to replace the work of the Law Commission. In fact, it is to build on the work of the Law Commission in their areas of funding, reporting requirements, penalties, revolving door limits, and gift limitations. I do believe there's some provisions in Senate Bill 10 that are similar to the Law Commission's work. And we do intend to address other issues regarding the Law Commission a few weeks down the road. We are hoping to coordinate, and this is a message to the House because I think they're listening, Senator Nelson, that we would really like to coordinate with them, particularly as we bring members of the Law Commission before us. We'd really like to work with the House as we do that. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Before Mr. Ruttlinger starts, I'd like to use this forum as an opportunity to acknowledge the heroic work that he did during the interim, sitting in trying to help the interim committee that worked on ethics issues make sense of all of the proposals and the voluminous amount of paperwork. He really did extraordinary work, and I would just like to use this opportunity to acknowledge that.
Thank you. We extend to you our official committee kudos. You were amazing. I mean, absolutely incredible. And just another aside, because of the expedited timeline we're going to use on this bill, we would ask all members of the public, all members of the lobby to submit amendment requests to Hans Bernard in my office so he can work to make sure that legislative council gets them drafted. So any amendments must come through Hans, not me, don't give them to me, please, Hans Bernard in the Senate Majority Office. So with that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 10. We already did that. Mr. Ruttlinger.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ted Ruttlinger with the Legislative Council's Office. What I hope to do is to briefly walk you through this bill and just explain in some detail what is in it. The first section, commission findings.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ferrioli.
Are we to hold our questions to the end of the walkthrough, or can we ask our questions as we're going through?
It's up to you. We have an hour and a half, well, an hour and 15 minutes now to get through his testimony, some testimony from the Law Commission, and the testimony from the director of the GSPC. So it might be most efficient if we hold our questions to the end, which is going to be very hard to do. Would you be willing to do that?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, let's go.
Okay. First, thank you for all of your kind words. I also want to acknowledge the work of the Law Commission staff and everybody else who sat through many, many different meetings on this all through the year and were a great help to me in doing this work. Sections 2 to 3 of this bill are on funding for the GSPC. They include provisions that were in Senate Bill 420 from last session. Basically, it directs the GSPC to estimate its expenses and then to assess each public body in this state an amount that's not specified in this bill yet for each public official that serves. That money is then transferred to the GSPC account and is used to fund the operations of the commission. It would apply first for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2009. The second part is reporting generally. That's sections 4 to 8 of this bill. The first two sections there affect lobbying statements. They would change the schedule for statements that are filed by lobbyists and by entities that employ lobbyists to a quarterly system every year. Right now, in even-numbered years, there are two statements filed, and in odd-numbered years, three statements by lobbyists and entities filed once. This would move everybody to quarterly. Secondly, it would require those statements to be filed electronically with the GSPC and direct the commission to make those statements available online for people to look at. Finally, for the filing things, there is another requirement that would require public officials who have to file statements of economic interest to do that electronically. And for all the additional statements that we'll talk about in a minute for gift reporting and other reporting, those would also have to be filed electronically with the GSPC. Third, civil penalties. The bill raises the maximum civil penalty for both violations of the lobbying law and the ethics law from $1,000 to a maximum of $5,000. It also raises the penalty that would apply for late statements on SEIs in particular from $5 a day to $10 a day and then up to $50 a day after the 14th day and again up to a $5,000 maximum. It also specifies for campaign finance violations that principal campaign committee funds may not be used to pay civil and criminal penalties that are assessed against a public official. But there's an exception there for civil penalties that are imposed under the election laws by either the Secretary of State or the Attorney General. You could use campaign funds to pay those election law penalties. The next major section is the subsequent employment revolving door. What the language in Section 15 of the bill is intended to do is say that a person who has been a member of the legislature may not become a compensated lobbyist during the period that starts when they leave the legislature and that ends at the sine die of the next legislative session, regular session, that occurs after they leave the legislature. So, for example, if somebody who served in the last session and whose term expired Monday, under this bill, they could not be a compensated lobbyist during this session. If you were to resign today, under this bill, you could not be a lobbyist for the remainder of this session or for the following regular legislative session. Or for any intervening special session that it might occur during that time. Moving on to gifts and financial gain, this is complicated. Basically, what this bill does is, first of all, change the gift limit. Under existing law, it's $100 from a person who has a legislative or administrative interest. Those people cannot give public officials gifts of over $100. This bill changes the limit to $50 and says that a public official, a candidate, or a relative cannot solicit or receive an aggregate amount of over $50 from a person who has a legislative or administrative interest. That's in a calendar year. And it also says, of course, that a person who has a legislative interest may not offer or give you a gift that exceeds the $50 limit. Then the key question, of course, is what becomes a gift under existing law. A gift is defined as anything of economic value that's not extended to other people who are not public officials on the same terms. And there are several exemptions from that gift definition. And those exemptions are campaign contributions, gifts from family members, food, lodging, and travel expenses where you travel to an event in your official capacity, food and beverage that's experienced in the presence of the provider, and entertainment that's experienced in the presence of the provider. Those are things that are exempt under existing law and that lobbyists who have a legislative interest may provide to you outside of the $100 limit. Senate Bill 10 changes those exemptions in the following ways. First of all, campaign contributions are still exempt. Second, contributions to a legal expenses trust fund, which is covered later in this bill, would be exempt. Gifts from relatives are still exempt. Gifts from personal friends on special occasions are exempt. Unsolicited tokens or awards of appreciation, like plaques, things like that, are exempt. Unsolicited informational material, publications, things that are related to your official duties are exempt. admission to and food and beverage that are provided to you at a reception, a meal, a meeting that's held by an organization, and you appear at that meal or meeting to speak or answer questions or make a presentation, that the admission and the food and beverage are exempt. And finally, expenses that are provided to you for attendance at a meeting, a fact-finding mission, or some other occasion where you will give a speech, a presentation, be on a panel, or represent the state or local government. And that applies if the trip is paid for by a unit of government, federal government, state, local government, a Native American tribe, or a 501c3 nonprofit corporation that receives less than 5% of its funding from for-profit entities. So if those people paid for the trip, it would be permissible for a public official to accept those expenses and not run afoul of the gift limit. Moving to financial gain. As you know, there's another statute in the ethics law now that prohibits the use of official office for personal financial gain. And what that law says is that you can't use your office for financial gain or to avoid detriment, where the opportunity for the gain or the opportunity to avoid the detriment arises just because you are a public official. There are, for this statute, also several exemptions. Those are for official compensation, honoraria, reimbursement of expenses, and unsolicited awards for professional achievement. What this bill does is retain all of those current exemptions and add several additional ones as follows. First, it says that it's okay for you to receive gifts that are underneath the $50 limit from people with a legislative or administrative interest. That's how the current law is interpreted. This would simply state that. Second, it would say that it's okay for public officials to receive gifts from people who do not have a legislative or administrative interest. Right now, the current law is interpreted the other way. If you have a legislative interest, you may give a gift of up to $100. If you have no legislative or administrative interest, and you're giving somebody a gift just because they're a public official, you are prohibited from doing that. This would say that if you have no legislative interest or administrative interest, you may give a gift and it's not subject to limit. Third, it says that you may give a gift of anything that is specifically exempt from the definition of gift. That seems obvious, but this just simply states it in the law that if it's exempt from the gift, it's okay for you to receive it without violating the financial gain statute. And finally, it says that it's okay for you to receive contributions to a legal defense fund that you might establish. So those are things that are also exempt from the financial gain law. Moving on to reporting of gifts, in Section 21 of Senate Bill 10, it establishes a whole new system for gift reporting. Right now, a lot of gifts that public officials might receive are not subject to reporting, except by the lobbyists who might give them. This would establish a new reporting requirement for public officials who are required to file statements of economic interest. So it narrows the field substantially. It's only the people who have to file the annual statement of economic interest that have to file these new gift reports on a quarterly basis with the Government Standards and Practices Commission. And what you would have to report are any gifts with a value between $15 and $50 that you receive from a person who has a legislative interest. Those would have to be reported on a quarterly basis electronically with the GSPC. Second, you would have to report any of the trip expenses that are allowed under this bill that you received when you went to a convention and you were a fact-finding trip or something like that. Third, you'd have to report any honoraria that you received between $15 and $50. And fourth, you have to report in this new report any source of income that exceeds $1,000 in the calendar quarter that you might have received from somebody who's doing business with the government body that you work for, or that has a legislative or administrative interest in the government body that you are working for. That requirement is currently contained in the the SEI statute and applies to you as you file an annual statement. What this would do is move it simply to a quarterly report, so you would have to report it for the preceding quarter instead of for the preceding calendar year. Further, under this statute, anybody who has a legislative interest who gives you a gift between $15 and $50 would also have to file a report with the GSPC listing that gift. This says that if you are a lobbyist and you otherwise have to file lobbying reports, and you would ordinarily include that on your lobbying report, that you can do that. You do not have to file an additional gift. And then finally, anybody who pays expenses for you to go on a trip that's exempted under this bill has to, within 10 days, provide you notice of how much they spent, which is similar to the current law, where if somebody pays food, lodging, and travel to an official event, they are supposed to give you notice within 10 days of that amount so that you can list it on your form. This bill retains that. It also requires people who provide you with honoraria to give you notice of the amount of the honoraria, and it provides that people who give you a gift need to provide you notice of the amount of the gift so that you can then report that amount on your quarterly statement with the GSPC. Okay, the rules on honoraria. This right now, statewide officials cannot get honoraria. The governor can. Legislators may not get honoraria for in-state appearances or for any appearance during a legislative session. During an interim, you can get honoraria outside of the state. Other public officials are not limited on honoraria under existing law. This bill would restrict honoraria for every public official to a maximum of $50 or less. It would also state that you may receive honoraria if you're giving a presentation that is related solely to your private profession. If you're an accountant and you're giving a speech on accountants and it's unrelated to your status as a state senator, this bill would allow you to receive honoraria for that. Finally, beginning in Section 29, this bill incorporates the legal defense trust fund concept that is also moving forward in the Oregon Law Commission process. And basically what this says is that a public official who expects to incur legal expenses because the public official needs to defend themselves in an action that's brought by a public body, that's brought against the public official by a public body, and where the action relates to or arises from the course and scope of duties of that person as a public official, that public official may establish a legal defense trust fund, solicit and receive contributions to that fund, which is then used to pay for legal expenses that the public official might incur in defending themselves. These sections say that the public official may not use this money for personal purposes. You can only establish one fund at a time. The public official may not personally solicit, receive, or handle any of the money. There has to be a trustee to do those things. The money must be used to defray legal expenses, to pay any costs of administering the fund, and to pay any taxes that might result from administration of the fund. To set up the fund, a public official needs to apply to the GSPC, provide certain information, designate a trustee. If the GSPC finds that everything's in order, they would approve the establishment of the fund. The bill says that you cannot form a fund and raise money until the GSPC does approve establishment of the fund. The trustee would then collect the money, deposit it in a bank account, would authorize expenditures. There are limits on who can be trustee. Can't be a relative of a public official or anybody who works for the same public body as the public official. Anybody can make unlimited contributions to the legal expenses trust fund except a principal campaign committee. They may not make contributions to a legal expenses trust fund. There has to be a single dedicated bank account. All money has to flow in and out of that account. And then the trustee has to file quarterly reports with the GSPC that list contributions and expenditures similar to the reporting that a political committee would have with the Secretary of State. And then finally, the public official can terminate the fund. The trust agreement itself can terminate the fund, or the GSPC can terminate the fund if there's violations. found by the commission. Any money that's left over has to be distributed on a prorated basis to contributors. And if there's an award of attorney's fees or some other money judgment that comes in as a result of this action, that money needs to be spent on legal expenses, returned to contributors, or given to the public official or a 501c3 charity. Finally, these provisions are all drafted now so that they become operative on January 1st, 2008. There's an emergency clause that gives the GSPC and any other public body time to do anything that they need to do before January 1st in order to get ready to apply the law on that date. And that's it. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Ferriello, do you want to start off?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was a lot. That's a lot of stuff. Mr. Ellinger, can you talk a little about the definition of public body? That's
yes.
referred to throughout the document.
Yes. The definition of public body is very broad, and it comes from a statute which defines public body, state government, executive department, everybody. Basically, a public body means state government bodies, local government bodies, and special government bodies. And it includes the world. It includes local government, the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, cities, counties, districts, the world.
It's a big universe.
It's a big universe.
Madam Chair, I guess the... If I could just get sort of back into this with just a few interrogatives about whom.
Please proceed.
Fair board? Elective fair board?
Yes.
Cemetery district board?
Yes.
Are these people that we've had file GSPC forms heretofore?
I don't know if any of those folks are listed in the Statement of Economic Interest statute off the top of my head. That's a statute that goes on for several pages in the ORS, and there are many public officials who do have to file Statements of Economic Interest. What this bill would do, as far as new reporting, would be to apply mostly to those people who currently have to file SEIs with the GSPC.
Madam Chair, and I think that there's a voluminous list of those that are covered by the law in the existing
statute. Currently, yes.
Yes.
I believe it's 200,000. Is that correct?
I think the number of public officials in this state
is 200,000. Okay.
Yeah.
The number that have to apply, fill out the SEI statement is different.
Yes.
Okay.
The number who have to file SEIs is substantially smaller.
Yeah, I think it's in the several thousands, but not anything approaching that big number. Yeah, less than that probably.
Yeah.
4,000. It's about
4,000,
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
For the record. Would this expand significantly the universe of filers?
I do not, Madam Chair, Senator Ferriello, I don't think it would significantly expand the universe of public officials who have to file. It would potentially expand the universe of other people who have to report gifts that they may have made to public officials. In many cases, those folks are going to be lobbyists who have a legislative and administrative interest and are already required by law to report. But there are other people who may not be registered lobbyists who give gifts that will be swept into the system and who do not now have to report.
And, Madam Chair, I think that Mr. Rettlinger has exactly put his finger on the concern that I have here. The way I read the bill, and it's probably wrong, is that... there's going to be a lot of unintended consequences because people who will be required to file who've never filed before won't understand their requirement. For instance, this is reaching a little, but Fair Board members donate hundreds of hours annually to uncompensated hours to produce an event. And it's in Grant County, just for instance, it's the Fair and Rodeo. And they're not compensated, but they do receive tickets to the events. And that's not compensation, ergo it may be a gift. And although there isn't necessarily what you'd consider a legislative interest, Fair Board employees who would be giving these passes regularly are subject to the discriminations of the Fair Board. So in a sense, it could be considered a gift from somebody that has an interest in the decisions of the board. There are lots of examples that we need to go through and decide whether we're creating some unintended consequences. I, for instance, received a pin on the first day of the legislative session. It's not compensation. It is from a public entity. I don't know that the person that gave me the gift has any legislative interest. I'll bet it's worth more than $15. And so I'm curious about whether or not there's an obligation to file. It just seems to me that we're in an area that may end up scooping up fire district members, cemetery board members and staff, other public officials that are elected in special districts that normally would not ever be expected to have to file these documents. And the problem with that is that failure to file is a violation. The fines are automatic. The GSPC isn't required to have a finding of fact or a hearing for the violation to go on record as a prima facie violation. And so the demand letter could follow. And I foresee a situation where somebody who's utterly unaware that they were required to file gets a notification that their failure is a violation, and then there follows a demand letter with no hearing. So, I mean, those are all provisions within SB 10 as I read them. So that would be an issue that I think we should go into.
Thank you.
May I?
Sure. Senator Farrelly, and your concerns are duly noted. This is the first hearing we've had with Bill. Mr. Rutlinger worked very hard to get this drafted to meet our timeline. So
Madam Chair, I have
a perfect product.
I can refrain from further questions.
Questions are appropriate if we keep it to that and kind of move through the bill, and then I assume other committee members have questions.
Madam
as well.
Chair, on the very issue, the topic that he brought up, could I ask a question regarding that too?
Sure.
Senator Farrelly mentioned elected volunteers. I type them that way. But what about those volunteers that aren't elected, that have economic interests? And a lobbyist from one of the cities came to me talking about they have so many volunteers that deal with things that could be an economic interest to them one way or another. But how would volunteers be treated under the way it's written now? Like a neighborhood association.
Madam Chair, Senator Montesanderson, the bill does not change the definition of public official in the ethics law, which is very broad and does cover volunteers who serve the state or any political subdivision of the state. But it does not impose any new reporting requirements on people who do not already have to file a statement of economic interest with the GSPC. I'm not sure that I otherwise fully understand your question.
Well, if they are required to pay a fee for every member, that would include
them. You're talking about the fees at the outset, correct?
Yeah.
You're talking about sections 2 and 3.
Yes.
Which page?
Okay.
Which line?
All right. So, Senator Montesanderson, I'm going to have you hold your question, and then we're going to go back to Senator Farrelly.
Sorry.
So why don't you keep on going through the bill and ask your questions, and then we'll go back to Senator Montesanderson.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask the questions for the record, and I won't expect an answer to the questions today. I think we'll just get the questions on the record, and that will expedite our process. And to Senator Montesanderson's issue, do we have a list of people that are required to file?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, a list of people who are required to file
the GSPC forms.
The Statement of Economic
yes,
Interest?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, that's in the statutes.
Okay. And is it possible for us to produce a list of the people that are subject to Senate Bill 10 if it passes in its present form?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, probably that would be difficult because it would apply in many instances to all public officials in the state, of which there are many.
Thank you. the SB 10 requires an electronic filing. Madam Chair, the question I would put on the record is that would it be possible to maintain both systems since there are some folks who are serving in such obscure capacities in public bodies that they don't even have access to a PC, and could they file their form by mail as we do before? That's a question I would ask. Another question is in under the civil penalty section, will the authority have ability to waive penalties if the violations are considered to be so trivial as to not rise to the level of intentional violation? I think we need to know that there could be a exercise of mercy and a waiver, so that that's a question I would ask. I would also ask why the commission exempts it.
Sarah Ferrioli, let's have Mr. Rutlinger answer that.
Sure.
If it's available.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, that concept is specifically included in one of the law commission drafts and would allow the commission the opportunity to issue a letter of reprimand instead of imposing a penalty. The way this is written now, it seems to me that the commission may have the authority to not impose a monetary penalty if it decides not to. But if you want to have something in there that specifically gives the commission the authority to issue something besides a monetary civil penalty, then that would be something to add to these civil penalty provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Rutlinger. The commission exempts itself from the requirement to find a violation, and I wonder if that doesn't create some due process issues.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, which section are you talking about?
Under Section 11, the commission exempts itself from ORS 244.260, finding a violation. It's at the bottom of page 5.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, that language is, it's taken from existing law. It's in 244.050, which is the statute that lists everybody who has to file a statement of economic interest. The intent of the drafter was simply to move that to the civil penalty section so that all of the civil penalty language was in the next section. It may be that I have not artfully captured the concept, but what the existing law is intended to say is that in cases where somebody simply has not filed a statement, that the commission does not have to go through the long investigatory preliminary review phrase statute to determine that somebody has simply not filed the statement. That's what this language is intended to say. And if it doesn't quite say that, then that's my fault in writing it.
Madam Chair, as I read that section, it occurred to me that what we were doing is exempting the commission from actually having to go through the process of a hearing or giving an adversarial opportunity for the accused, I guess, to stand and say, no, that's not right. So
that's not the intent, then we need to work on it a little. To say they don't have to go through the whole process if somebody has not filed a statement, period.
Thank you. Madam Chair, on page 8, in section 15, the Senate Bill 10 eliminates legislative oversight of the creation of the people, of the list of people who must file. And I wondered about that.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, that, again, is a change that we undertook in our office because it's legally unnecessary. The legislature may maintain legislative oversight over any statute at any time and may change the law as it sees fit. So it has no legal effect, which is why it's taken out. Nobody asked me to take it out. It's simply, if you want it in there, we'll put it back in.
Okay.
Not a big deal.
Well, Madam Chair, it just seems to me that if it's in there, I can ask my colleagues to do their duty according to the statute and engage in legislative oversight. If it's not, then I have to convince them to do their duty. So.
After our discussion yesterday on persuasion skills. I'm sure you're very able of doing that, very capable of doing that, sir.
Occasionally, Madam Chair, not always. I'm going to ask one more question, and then I'm going to refrain from further questions because I've got many more, but I know that my colleagues have questions as well. In Senate Bill 10, the revolving door is defined as legislators who might become lobbyists. And I would just submit to my colleagues that there are many more participants in the process of the revolving door. And just to give hypotheticals, it's always seemed odd to me that legislators who voted on agency budgets would find themselves one morning as the director of the agency on whose budgets they voted. And that seems somewhat strange to me. It always also seems a bit strange that lobbyists who had control of PAC money, who were active in an election cycle, could find themselves in key positions in the administrations that they helped elect. So I would suggest that I would solicit my colleagues' assistance in expanding the definition of the revolving door so that the participants in this process, which include legislators and lobbyists and members of the administration and others, elected public officials and others, are all subject to the same cooling off period. So I would just suggest to you that we've even had recent instances of legislators being instrumental in the creation of new agencies and waking up one morning finding themselves the chair of that agency or the director of the agency. So it just seems to me that if we're going to level the playing field on the revolving door, then it needs to apply equally to lobbyists, legislators, and others that have a direct interest in this process. Thought I'd solicit your assistance on that. I mean, that, Madam Chair, brings chapter one of my voluminous numbers of questions to a close.
And we could solve our recruiting problems if we prohibited legislators from taking a job whatsoever as they leave the legislature, and then we wouldn't have any trouble recruiting for the legislature.
Well, Madam Chair, for a year perhaps, what we're doing now with this bill is preventing people from moving from the lobby or from the legislature to the lobby. Mm-hmm. But if it's truly a revolving door, we have people moving from the lobby to the administration, from the administration to the lobby. I mean, there's a lot of different permutations.
Thanks for raising that issue. Senator Montes-Anderson, questions?
Yes. Number one, does this electronic system exist now, or is it in the works?
Madam Chair, Senator Montes-Anderson, it does not exist now, as I understand it, and I do not believe that it's in the works.
And that would be a horrendous amount of money. I'm not savvy as to implementing.
Madam Chair, I know we're Anderson, I don't know how much it would cost. I do know that the Secretary of State has recently been working on and implementing an electronic campaign finance reporting system that I suspect costs them quite a bit of money.
And we're having a little difficulty with that. But I was just wondering if that would be, is that why the cost in setting a fee, will those expenses be a part of what sets the fee for everybody?
Madam Chair, Senator Montes-Anderson, I don't know the answer to that question. I think the way this is drafted now, it's intended to be an ongoing amount of money available to the Commission for its expenses. I would assume that if the legislature directs the commission to adopt an electronic filing system, that might take an additional appropriation of money to the commission to fund the development and implementation of that system itself.
All right, moving on to, I can't remember if it's 12 or 13, regarding civil penalties and not being able to use campaign funds. A lot of errors are made where you the email didn't get through, you're a day late in filing, so you're fined. There are a lot of fines that we pay, but the intent was not to be malicious or break the law. How does this read? Any fine could not ever be then used. You could not use campaign funds.
Madam Chair, Senator Montes-Anderson, that's right, except for the fact that you could use campaign funds to pay for election law-related penalties. So you could, under this bill, use your campaign account to pay for contribution and expenditure civil penalties that the Secretary of State imposed on you for a report that's late or for something that's more serious under the election laws.
Sometimes a check wasn't entered in the proper time frame. We see the error, we file an amendment, and yet we were still fined. You say then that would be,
yes,
we could use campaign.
Yes, you could use campaign funds to pay that fine.
And then the other question I had is where you win prizes. It's not really a gift, but the lobby has a lot of fundraisers and candidates, and the caucuses have fundraisers. And, like, if you win a raffle, a $50 raffle or a $100 raffle, or in a golf tournament, your team wins and you win a golf bag or you win a golf club as a prize, is that then considered a gift? Should we be accepting that or should we not be accepting that?
Senator Brown, Senator Montes-Anderson, that's a difficult question. I know there are GSPC opinions on people attending golf tournaments, but I can't remember what they say. It would depend on whether or not it meets the definition of a gift, and if it's an event that's open to the public and everybody has an opportunity to participate and you're not there just because you're a public official, then maybe it's not a gift.
No,
but
it's not that case.
Otherwise, you know, unless it fits within one of the exemptions, then it is possible that that would be a gift subject to the limit.
Okay. Senator Montes-Anderson, I didn't worry about that too much because I never win anything. So,
well, there are not very many women golfers, and sometimes I do. I'm only one or two. And okay, you answered that question already with Ferrioli. You answered that one. I think that's all for now, Senator Brown. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Montes-Anderson. Sarah Nelson, any questions?
I'm just listening.
Okay. Mr. Rotenlayer, how is legislative interest defined? I mean, can you tell me what is whether someone has a legislative interest or not?
It basically means that you have to have an economic interest distinct from the general public in something that's before, in your case, the legislature. In a bill, in a resolution, in some action that the legislature can take. You need to have a distinct distinct economic interest in that bill or legislation in order to have a legislative or administrative interest. Obviously, this definition applies to local governments, to the executive branch, and everybody else. So basically, it's a distinct economic interest in something.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, any questions?
No, I'm fine.
All right. Well, I think you're done for the day, at least with this committee. We really
Thank
appreciate
you
your hard work, and thanks for getting this
Thank
done
you.
So quickly.
You're welcome.
All right. Let's have Wendy Johnson come on up with the Law Commission. And I wanted to note for the record that every committee member should have received from Janice Thompson a 2.5-page document related to Senate Bill 10. It's from the Money and Politics Research Action Project, and we'd ask that be included in your written testimony. And Wendy, did you want to bring the chair of the Law Commission up with you, as well as the Attorney General, Hardy Myers? Okay. And you should have, in addition to the MIPRAP handout that I just mentioned, you should have a handout from Wendy Johnson with an overview talking about the differences between the Law Commission recommendations and Senate Bill 10, as well as a PowerPoint in paper. So thanks and welcome, and we really appreciate your very, very hard work.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission, for the records. I just want to thank the committee for inviting this testimony this morning. I wanted to talk just about a couple of things. First, who the Law Commission is, for those committee members who are unfamiliar with the commission and also the public. And then I wanted to talk briefly about how this project came to be before the Law Commission, and then direct your attention to the handouts that explain the differences between Senate Bill 10 and what the Law Commission has been working on during this last interim. But to focus on the Law Commission itself, obviously the gentleman to my right and left are a big part of the Oregon Law Commission. The Law Commission is composed of 13 members, and the membership is codified in statute of who's to be on the commission. And our commission has all three branches of government represented. We have the executive branch. We have a governor's appointment. That present appointee is Professor Hans Lindy, former Justice Lindy of the Oregon Supreme Court. We also have the Attorney General, sitting to my right here, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, Chief Justice Paul DeMunis. We have two members that are appointed by the Senate President and two members appointed by the House Speaker. Our present members are from the Senate President's office. Senator Kate Brown is appointed by the Senate President, as well as John DiLorenzo, partner at Davis Wright Tremaine. From the House Speaker appointed Director Lane Shetterly from Land Conservation and Development, and former representative from Eugene, Representative Bob Ackerman. And then rounding out the Law Commission, we have three members that are appointed by the Board of Governors of the Oregon State Bar. That's the highest governing body of the bar. We have two appointments right now where we have a vacancy right now, but those two members are Sandra Hensberger, who's the Executive Director of the Campaign for Equal Justice in the state, and the other bar appointment is Greg Mao, a partner at Stoll Reeves. And then finishing out our 13-member commission is the deans of each of Oregon's three law schools, or the dean can appoint a member. So presently, the dean of Willamette University College of Law, Dean Simeon Simeonides, Professor Dom Vetri from the University of Oregon Law School, and Professor Bernie Vail from Lewis and Clark Law School. So that's our 13-member commission created by this body to do law reform. That's our sole purpose, is law reform. We can't actually pass any legislation, obviously. Our job is to recommend to this body law reform. The law commission was created in 1997 by this body and was not funded until 2000. So we're still a new commission in that respect. And this would be our fourth session. We started out with small law reform projects, and over the last two sessions, particularly, we have added very complicated law reform projects. And having been on the commission as staff since 2001, I've seen the commission sort of grow in terms of its responsibility. But I think to explain that responsibility would be to acknowledge how busy this body it has become focused on the budget, and there's less and less time to focus on traditional law reform, especially those complicated systemic areas of law. So with that, that's our commission. The chair of the Law Commission is Lane Shetterly. He's been the chair since the commission was created by this body, and it's just an amazing body of blue ribbon lawyers. Right now, all 13 do happen to be lawyers. It's not required, but they all are lawyers who are very active in our community with very busy jobs, but they all serve as volunteers. We have a small staff, and that staff is housed at Willamette University College of Law. It's funded through a very unique partnership. Willamette University has continually paid for the Law Commission at least half of the budget, voluntarily paid for half of the budget. And so the state has not had to pay a significant amount of money to have this blue ribbon panel and its staff, because the Willamette University has paid for half of it. But it is significant to note that with this ethics project, a project that the commission undertook this interim, an additional appropriation was made by this body. So I would like to transition into how this project came, I just would turn it to Director or Chair Lane Shetterly to add anything more about the commission since he serves as chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, in this case, sitting with my hat on as chair of the Oregon Law Commission, and pleased to be here this morning. I think in the interest of time, Wendy has covered enough of the basis of the commission, and your interest is probably more focused on Senate Bill 10 and the ethics reform project that the commission has been involved in. So I think I'll just defer to Wendy unless you have any other questions about the commission itself.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Opportunistic as I am on this issue, I would love to have the occasion to visit with the Law Commission about a fuller participation of the other two law schools in working on commission activities. I think the good chair and I are graduates of one of the non-financially participating law schools. And I just opened that door for your consideration.
Thank you. Just so you know, in the history of it, when we initially wanted to partner with one of Oregon's law schools to provide a staffing home, we did open up an RFP process to all three schools. Our alma mater elected not to participate in that. The two other law schools did, although I will say that we have excellent participation from Bernie Vail, professor from our alma mater, who has been very active involved in the invitation.
Forgive me for not acknowledging your matriculation from that same institution.
Senator Johnson, I was as well, so
I know.
Yeah, we're just like,
I hear a dash one coming.
But I also echo that Professor Vail has been very involved. In fact, one of the proposals that he's been working on, I think, since the beginning of the Law Commission, is going to be coming before the legislature this time around. So, Mr. Attorney General, do you wish to add anything at this point? Okay.
No,
all right.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, then to transition into, okay, that's who our Law Commission is. How did we end up with a law reform project this interim on government ethics? We take on a number of projects. Many of them are recommended by our own commissioners, but more and more they're actually coming from judges, lawyers, agencies in the state. This session, for example, we're doing an overhaul of government bonding, state and local, and that was a joint request from the Treasurer's Office and the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. And we have this project that was requested by both the governor and the assembly. We have projects that were requested by juvenile court persons, including juvenile departments, juvenile court judges, and defense attorneys, as well as DAs. So our projects come from a variety of sources. The ethics project has its history going back to 2003. In 2003, Governor Kulongoski, in a veto letter on a bill that had some ethics reform, asked the Oregon Law Commission to look at the area of government ethics. That happened after session at the end of 2003. The Law Commission considered the request and wanted to accept, but recognized the complexity of the project and the, frankly, without the resources and our already full agenda. In 2003, our response was, we're interested, but we couldn't do it for 2005 anyway, and so we deferred that until perhaps a 2007 session. Then this body in 2005 made an appropriation at the end of session and made the project possible in a bill passing in the late days of the 2005 session. Immediately after that appropriation was made, a work group, the Law Commission met and decided to go ahead and form a work group. Commissioner Attorney General Hardy Myers agreed to chair that project, and a work group was formed to begin work, and that work group met first in November of 2005, so just shortly after the 2005 session. It's been my pleasure to work as staff member to that esteemed work group, which was composed of 15 people and 13 advisors. Those 15 persons we asked to bring their expertise, but we asked them to not represent a client before the commission as a work group member. And then the 13 advisors came with expertise, but we asked them to bring their expertise, and some of them, in effect, were representing their clients. But we tried to make a distinction between those who were members, voting members, and those who were advising us with their expertise. So we had 28 people work on this project literally since November of 2005. That project culminated with the work groups finishing its work in November of 2006. And then the project was brought before the commission again for final passage and recommendation to this assembly. The commission had its final meeting on December 20th, so that's why you don't see our bills in printed form before you today. And at the end of the process, there were some 15 legislative concepts that were approved by the commission, and many of them were amended during the commission's final meeting on December 20th. Due to the holiday season and just the
the way the capital works, we have not filed those bills. And so today I sort of make this that request and provide notice that the commission and especially leadership would like to work with this committee now that the House and Senate have organized, also work with the Election Ethics and Rules Committee in the House side to decide how to take those 15 legislative concepts and introduce them preferably as committee bills. But we'd like to work with how to package those in which chamber of origin. I want to thank the Attorney General and Phil Schradl, his staff, for providing such excellent leadership throughout this long, over a year project, as well as the work group members who were meeting, if not once a month, two and three times a month to finish this. The Commission committed to a comprehensive reform, not just looking at a few of the hot-button issues, but to really look at the agency and all of the statutes that the that entail what's known as government ethics. That's two chapters of law, chapters 244 and 171. And so some of the issues we addressed are the sexy issues that have been in the press a lot, especially in recent months. It was interesting when we took this project, ethics was not a hot topic. When we were nearing completion, it became a bigger issue, and so we literally had a moving target, which has caused difficulty. I'm not prepared today to really go into lots of details on every recommendation, but
that's good because we don't have a lot of time. And we will be bringing you all back. So,
but I think it's important. One thing is very important to keep in mind, and I believe Senator Farioli raised it as well, is that one of the initial questions for the Law Commission and the work group to discuss was, shall Oregon keep its government ethics rubric of who it applies to the entire universe of public officials, or should different sets of rules be established for example, the legislature, the executive branch, local governments? And it was a conscious decision to keep it applicable to everyone, to have the same standards, and to provide as few exceptions as possible to make it easy for everyone to follow. And so even though the press in recent months has changed the landscape, I think it's important to not react too quickly, but to think about how this applies to everyone in the state. There are obviously points of contention that the Law Commission struggled.
And for Wendy, let me stop you right here. For everyone, you mean all of the 200,000 elected or public officials that our ethics codes apply to, correct?
Correct.
Not everyone in the state.
Correct.
Okay.
So, for example, if you change the meal rule for legislators, if you want to change that and you make it in Chapter 244, you're changing it for everyone, teachers, volunteer firefighters, a policeman, city council person, volunteers, you're changing it for everyone unless you're going to create a different set of rules. So sometimes it's easier to think about one group of people how to make a rule, but when you're talking about all 200,000, you have to make some compromises.
Okay. Sarah Johnson.
Thank you. I don't need a response for this. I just want to raise it for the record and as a point that we'll need to discuss, particularly with government standards and practices. And that is, as you expand the definition of who all is covered, and we're now sweeping in potentially a universe of 200,000 elected officials, what kind of enforcement mechanism comes along with this, and what kind of staffing should GSPC anticipate having in order to deal with a much larger universe and potentially a much more aggressive enforcement requirement? And so that really is outside of your purview. I just want to bring that up on the radar screen of things that I think we need to discuss.
Just perhaps clarification, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, and Wendy can correct me if I'm wrong. I think I am correct that the Law Commission project has not expanded the universe of public officials. There is the large universe to which the codes apply, and I think we have left that unchanged. There is a smaller universe, as you already touched on, of those public officials to whom the reporting requirements apply.
And
I don't think we've changed that either, except on the giver side.
Right.
But in terms of the burden on public officials and those to whom these rules apply, that remains unchanged under the Law Commission's bill. I shouldn't say bill. There is no bill. Proposal.
Thank you for that clarification. I will renew my concern at a much more global level, and that is to say that the only thing, in my opinion, worse than not acting on this very complex series of issues would be to put in place a mechanism that invites scofflaws. If we are undertaking this major overhaul, whether it's the Law Commission proposal, whether it is rules promulgated by either one of the wings of this building, whether or not it's Senate Bill 10, I want to just raise the clarion call for mechanisms that don't become bureaucratically cumbersome, but make sure that we are not creating and institutionalizing the ability to thumb one's nose at the ethics requirements, and we don't have in place the mechanisms to adequately address that.
Okay, thank you. All right, Ms. Johnson.
Just to sort of close then, obviously we have not filed these 15 legislative concepts. We need to provide those to you. We do have our recommendations summarized, and that is provided in the PowerPoint that was a handout for you today. There are just a couple of things that will help you read that. If it's on italicized font, that signifies a change in existing law. We thought it was important to provide you with the framework of how existing law works, and so we're not just providing you with a list of changes. We're trying to show you how it all fits in with present law. So you'll see the present law, but then you'll see some changes that are in italicized font. There's a couple of acronyms that I use. PO stands for Public Official, and SEI stands for the Statement of Economic Interest. I think the rest of the PowerPoint should be self-explanatory, but this is just provided as a summary to help you sort of track by topic how the recommendations of the Commission will appear in bill form when they're back from Legislative Council. Secondly, you have a memo before you that's five pages. The first 2.5 pages are a listing of a comparison, basically, of Senate Bill 10 and what the Law Commission approved to go forward as a recommendation to this body. Only two areas have definite conflicts between the recommendations that the Law Commission approved and what is in Senate Bill 10. They're in the area of funding and the area of gifts. And there's a summary provided for you in that memo. Gifts is complicated, as Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel Ted Rittlinger noted. So I've provided you with an additional 2 pages just on gifts. That's at the back of the memo that lists how gifts would be defined under both recommendations, or the bill and the Law Commission's recommendations, as well as the exceptions. And then there are some areas that are consistent, literally lifted from legislative concepts that the Law Commission is recommending and what's in Senate Bill 10, and those are listed under Roman numeral 2. But I think it's important to note that the Law Commission did look at the whole area of government ethics law and did a comprehensive review, and so there are many areas that Senate Bill 10 doesn't address at all. And so those are listed under Roman numeral 3. A through D listed there are topics that are covered in Senate Bill 10, but those recommendations listed there on page 2 are not in the bill, even though the topic is covered. And then those on page 3 under Roman numeral 4, those are topics that aren't covered at all by Senate Bill 10. So it's the difference that both Roman numeral 3 and 4 aren't covered in the bill, but the distinction is the topic in Roman numeral 3 is covered in Senate Bill 10.
Ms. Johnson, I know the Commission has wrestled with the funding piece, and I don't know if the Attorney General wants to speak briefly to this issue, but I didn't know if folks had specifically examined the proposal that is in Senate Bill 10 and rejected it, or had looked at other sort of funding mechanisms. I guess my goal here, and I assume the Commission's goal was somewhat similar, is to remove what I perceive as a conflict of interest between the legislature holding the purse strings to the Government Standards and Practices Commission and also the GSPC having oversight and holding legislators accountable for ethics laws. Mr. Attorney General, do you wish to speak to that?
Madam Chair, the work group, if I recall correctly, did consider the possibility of the concept of assessments or some form of compelled contribution to the costs of the Commission from public officials generally or other units of government. And I think I'm interpreting the work group's views correctly when I say that the decision was to simply stay with the general fund for the purposes of frankly, political simplicity at this point. I personally think that the whole issue of the funding of the commission warrants further specific study on an interim basis if it were the decision of the legislature to remain with the general fund as the source of the funding for at least the present. But I think there was unanimity at all times within the work group as to the desirability of trying to detach the actual amount of funding from the regular recurring budget-making process and create a mechanism which would provide ongoing funding without that process being implicated.
Sarah Jasso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in response to the Attorney General's comments, I was part of the work group. Regrettably, given some family health issues, I was not able to participate at the very end. This might be a question better posed to GSPC when they're before us, but I was disappointed in the, as you describe, for political simplicity, relying on the general fund. I was disappointed that that was the outcome, and I was hopeful that the opportunity for some kind of assessment might rise to the Law Commission and it be accepted. It is my recollection from the task force work that many of the complaints dealt with by GSPC come from local government, and I'm just double-checking with you all if my recollection is accurate.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I believe that is correct.
It was my contention, and had I been able to attend the last meetings, I would have made the case that I think a more global participation is appropriate. I can see the nexus. Relying on the general fund, I think, has made many of us uncomfortable, given the reasons stated by the chair. But I just at least would like to raise the funding issue and get on the record the fact that GSPC deals with a number of local government concerns, and that's why I would have am supportive of a more global assessment.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I don't think that certainly an approach of the kind described in Senate Bill 10 is by any means unprincipled or far-fetched, and of course it's ultimately your decision. I think that the overriding effort within the commission's within this part of the commission's work was to try to arrive at a way in which the integrity of the ongoing funding of the commission could be protected against, in effect, political retaliation for actions of the commission in trying to carry out its mandate, to be very straightforward about it.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. GSPC?
Yes.
Okay. Let me get to that question in just a second. And I don't know if the question's best directed for Ms. Johnson or the Attorney General. I just want to respond or have the Commission's response to the concerns raised earlier about requiring the GSP to establish an electronic searchable filing system. That's my understanding that is a Law Commission recommendation that's also recommended or in the Senate Bill 10. Could anybody respond to that or how the Commission came to that as a filing format, I guess, is what I would say.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, the reason that I think the work group came to this recommendation of electronic filing and as well as the Commission agreeing to that recommendation is that we wanted to increase the reporting requirements instead of once a year, and to facilitate a more frequent reporting, having it online easily with easy windows for people to click and fill in would just make it easy for people. In addition, public access is a problem under current law. All these records are public records, but they sit in a file cabinet in Government Standards and Practices Commission. It's difficult for people all over the state to look at the reports. You have to do a records request or come to Salem, and it just takes too much time. If you're in a legislative hearing and you want to know who's before you, you want to pull it up on your computer now, not a week later. And so just for ease and public access, both, I think, were the two primary reasons having it electronic. Also, in costs, these forms have to be mailed out and mailed back in, and just processing it, if it's electronic, you don't have all that processing time.
Do you have any concerns? Senator Farrioli raised the concerns of public officials not having access to a computer system.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm not positive how it's drafted, would be drafted in the Law Commission's recommendation, but requiring an electronic system be available doesn't mean that you're required to file it electronically. The forms would still be prescribed by GSPC.
So there would be alternatives.
Paper forms, yes.
Sarah Nelson, I'm just curious if there's anyone in your district that doesn't have access. I'm sure there are folks that don't have access to a computer, but if we're looking at city government officials, I mean, I'm trying to think. Cities of Troy probably are not on the Internet.
I mean, there's some, a lot of them do, a lot of them don't. I mean, it's.
But just to, again, clarify, Chair Brown, members of the committee, it's only those people who have to file a statement of economic interest.
SEI statement, correct. Okay. So we're only talking the 4,000.
And those 4,000 are generally high enough officials that I would think they would have a computer at the 4,000.
You can't be sure of that.
But you can't be sure, exactly. You have to.
So you still provide.
You have to allow,
okay.
But I don't think it's that big of a problem.
All right. That's very helpful. I guess the other question, I would certainly look to the Attorney General for this. The Law Commission also recommended prohibiting legislators from lobbying for a session succeeding the last session. And Senator Farioli raised the issue of, moving to agency. I'm curious why you stopped at the lobbying field, why you didn't look to administration. I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you want to address that as well, but
I think it's I'm a registered lobbyist. That may surprise everybody, but as an agency director, my responsibility involves frequent appearance to the legislature, so actually that would apply, I think, probably to most directors.
Okay.
So it is more extensive than one might think of when you think of moving to the lobby.
Okay.
Senator Johnson?
I want to, Madam Chair, just revisit the exchange you had with Senator Nelson. I am less concerned about access as I am about system integrity, accuracy, availability, like it's up and functioning more than it's down. We need a functioning system that protects personal data, avoids external manipulation, is reasonably able to be manipulated by normal human beings.
Senator Johnson, like some of the issues we're having with, we're concerns about our current contribution expense forms being.
God, you're clairvoyant. You read my mind.
Yeah, all right. I don't know, Ms. Johnson, if the commission wants to respond to that or you want to wait for Mr. Burson to come up from the GSPC, but we appreciate you raising that issue, and obviously it's foremost in our minds right now with what's happening in the Secretary of State's office. So I don't know if you want to respond or not.
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, the only thing I would respond was that we did involve Secretary of State's office in this process.
That frightens me.
I think the answer is we worked a lot with John Lindbeck on this issue, and acknowledging that the system is new and will have its bugs. It was an expensive system that I understand is the platform is capable of adding on additional databases. And so the belief is a system of reporting for the GSPC could be attached to the Secretary of State's platform. I understand that platform is having its own difficulties, but assuming the computer geeks out there can fix it, it should be doable and not be a reinvention of the wheel in terms of costs and functions. So you should be able to log on to your computer and file your CNE and also file your GSPC report, which would make it more user-friendly if those bugs can be worked out. But the legislation that's proposed does not require using the Secretary of State's office, but that was definitely a recommendation to try to save money if it's possible.
Senator Johnson?
I would just say let's make sure we're building on a steady foundation.
Message received.
Other questions on the Senator Nelson?
Thank you. When the commission's work, and thank you for the work, seems to me you've got some real complicated issues. You've got a federal case, the Valero case, V-A-L-E-R-O, is that right, that allows certain things to happen, certain things that you've got. Oregon free speech rights, and a case that covers those things. It seems to me that there's so many complications in all that whatever we do, we're going to have unintended consequences and may be subject to a legal review at some particular time. Was that part of the discussion with the commission?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, yes, it was as we went along. And I think it's safe to say the commission believes that all of its recommendations would pass constitutional attack. I think there are a relatively small number where free speech issues are truly implicated, but I think that as they're coming into the legislature, they would survive constitutional attack.
Senator Nelson, go ahead.
Another question, just to kind of follow up. I mean, one of the objects, of this whole body is to say, how do you get more people to run for public office? More good people, I guess. Or just people. But it seems to me that where the direction we're going in this thing is that you're basically going to be limited to the people that have means to do it. And I think that's a very serious thing that we have to consider in an overall aspect of this. I mean, we could focus on it satisfying the press and, you know, our political whatever, you know, is this going to hurt us politically? But what is the incentive for a person to come in? Anecdotally, I've had so many people come to say to me as the result of all these things, I wouldn't have your job for anything. Because all of us probably have something in our background that are, you know, why do we want to be subject to this thing? Why would we want to subject ourselves to the scrutiny of a public official?
Chair Shetterly.
Since we're waxing philosophical, that's a very good question. And in fact, you'll note that one of the exemptions from the definition of gift is compensation. And I think it is ultimately a fundamental policy decision. Do we need, as a state, do we need to address remuneration for some of these level of services more seriously to create that incentive? And is it the appropriate incentive, on the other hand, to give flex on gift statutes and things like that to make up for what the state doesn't provide in the way of compensation? Frankly, having been in this body myself, I think you are woefully underpaid for the services that you provide. And I think if the state were to address that, that would create the incentive, I think, for more people entering without sacrificing what is required of the time and energy that it takes to be, in this case, a member of the legislature.
Since we're talking this, I'm trying to think what makes a good legislator, you know, regardless of how you come in. And when I look at it, it's building relationships, getting as much information as you possibly can, and that includes time and travel. I mean, if I sit out in eastern Oregon, I don't understand what the issues are in the Long Island Valley, and vice versa. We don't have that interchange of things. And so my real concern about this is that we are actually smothering the very basics of what makes a good legislature, what makes this whole body work, you know. And we're not perfect, we all make mistakes, but there's something about sort of the dynamic sort of the enzymes. So somebody talked about enzymes yesterday that mixes and you do all these things and somehow you turn them out with a good product. So I know, were those things all considered in the law commission?
Chair Brown, Senator Nelson, that issue was discussed. In fact, when the first issue that the work group chaired by Attorney General Myers tackled was the area of campaign finance. And as we looked at that area, I literally looked at every C&E filed by every senator and representative for a discrete time period to sort of look at what our campaign money is being used for. And, you know, the average in a year was around $3,000 to do work that was what appeared to be to do work once in office. In other words, non-campaign type expenses, but just to be able to do your office elected to. And you don't see that phenomenon in other public offices. For example, the Attorney General or the Governor or a City Council person would not use campaign money to run their office. I mean, they have a budget. But it's a problem in the legislature that's different, and it's, as Chair Shetterly has explained, it's a problem that the legislature itself doesn't have the same resources that other public officials have. I mean, you have a very limited travel budget, if any travel budget. I believe the latest was zero. You have a very limited staff budget, and so your pots of money that are available are limited, and so campaign money was being used, gift money from lobbyists was being used, and so if you're going to cut off some of these valves, you also need to address the compensation issue. And you will see in the Law Commission's recommendations, it's a non-statutory recommendation, but it's a recommendation to address that staffing budget level. If you're going to cut off the campaign recommendations that the Law Commission is recommending, the corollary to go with that is a change in how
your own budget is handled.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I believe that the Commission on the Legislature's view with respect to campaign contribution use and the importance of adequate compensation for members and expense allowances for members, I think those are running exactly parallel with the Commission's views.
I just want to follow up on the questions regarding the lobby ban and ask both the Attorney General and Chair Shetterly, is by prohibition on lobbyists, is it broad enough but not too broad? You know, I believe the Commission came down on the same spot. Are we capturing the group of folks that have a more than a public interest in the legislative process? Mr. Attorney General, I don't know if you want to respond to that.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Are you referring to the restrictions on lobbying post-public service?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The revolving door, I think it's called.
Madam Chair, I think the answer is yes, but I certainly think that when that issue is again reached, and it's both in Senate Bill 10 and in the Law Commission's recommendations, in fact, they're duplicating recommendations right now on that point, I think it's certainly it would be an important inquiry to think through the question of whether the scope of the prohibitions are appropriate.
Okay. Chair Shetterly?
No, I agree. Okay. I think that would benefit from some careful thought, always attendant, and we've already heard the comments a couple times this morning about unintended consequences.
Okay. All right. I think at this point we're going to wrap up. We really appreciate you coming. We see this as the beginning of the conversation, and look forward to working with you and the House. Chair Shetterly.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just one last thing. It's housekeeping, I suppose, on our side. We do need to get LCs combined and ready for drafting. Should we work with your staff?
I think that would be good. And I'd also like to work with Representative Rosenbaum. We're coordinating
with
the House.
We'll set up a time then to get together.
Senator Johnson.
Just as a housekeeping, as we're kind of concluding, given the prominence that this issue has in the building at this moment in time, I would like to respectfully ask if we could make these handouts available to all of our Senate colleagues to completely inform them about the differences in the Law Commission recommendations in SB 10.
So let's do the PowerPoint, the Wendy Johnson memo, and let's also do the MIP wrap.
I have an ulterior motive, too. It'll put this PowerPoint in a font that my poor old aged eyes can read.
All right. Thank you very much for your hard work. Mr. Burson, we will look forward to having you sometime next week. I have Ms. Ingram and Mr. Armstrong signed up. Can we get you next week? Thank you. And Mr. Turl, rhymes with pearl, right? Are you available next week as well? Okay, great. We'd love to have you participate, and we'd love to get you on next week. We may have more than one hearing, so stay posted. We're obviously not getting all the work done we'd like to in an hour and a half, and I think Senator Walker and the prior committee also had that same concern. So thank you very much. And with that, if there's any other business, seeing none, we're adjourned.